It's always a pleasure to welcome our next speaker to the podium, Joyce Losey. Joyce earned a BS in journalism from Northern Illinois University in DeKalb, Illinois. She combines journalism and genealogy to write biographies for the, quote, "You Know, Now You Know" bio series from Filter Press. She is administrator for Women Writing the West and writes history-related articles for magazines such as True West, Steamboat Magazine, Colorado Central, and Women Out West. Awards include three various awards from tell me, Joyce, what is CIPAEVVY? Sounds good to me, okay. And a Silver Willa Award and a Colorado Authors League Award. In March 2008, she accepted induction into the Colorado Women's Hall of Fame for historical subject Eliza Rout. Joyce's interest in Western history has led her to present over 150 programs, and she has taken on her research jaunts to cemeteries and archives throughout Colorado. Welcome, Joyce.
In 1915, Spencer Penrose celebrated his 50th birthday. He had amassed a wonderful fortune through his ventures in mining, developing, building, and shrewd investing. It was now time to follow some of his interests and passions and have a little fun. So he decided to build a highway up Pike's Peak. Now, this was quite an undertaking, but he approached his business associates around town and looked for investors and amassed $25,000 for the project. And that was great, except that the road was 19 miles long, and the money ran out after 2 miles. But he would not be deterred. He decided that he would go ahead and pay for the rest of it himself, and he did. He put in over $250,000 of his own money to finish the project. Now, when Penrose took on something like this, he usually had something else up his sleeve, and the case was true here as well. The same year, he purchased the Manitou Incline, or what became the Manitou Incline, because he was trying to build scenic attractions for the Pikes Peak region, to be a tourist magnet, you might say, bring more people to the region. The population had kind of stabilized at 30,000, and he thought the economy needed a little boost. So he started this attraction called the Manitou Incline. Early riders of the cart, I guess you'd call it, it's not really a train, that went up the incline, said it was quite an adventure, not very comfortable, kind of scary, but there was a really great view at the top and it was all worthwhile. So it became popular. In the meantime, he went ahead and finished this automobile road up Pike's Peak. Now you have to keep in mind that the automobiles had only been in the Pike's Peak region or around the country for the last 15 years at the turn of the century and available to American citizens since Henry Ford produced the Model T in 1908. So it hadn't been very long, but it did require, if tourists were going to come and they wanted to go to the top of the mountain, it required a better road than the carriage road, two ruts going up that had been there previously. So he did finish it complete with 142 hairpin turns and decided that a car race needed to be an event on this road to bring more people to the Pikes Peak region. And that's how the Pikes Peak Hill Climb started. The first hill climb was in 1916, right after the road was finished. Now, there was another problem in that the dark cloud of World War I was hanging over the world at the time. And so there was one race in 1916, but there was not a second race until 1920. It did not become an annual event until 1920, when this gentleman, a German driver named Otto Losch, drove his Lexington car up in 22 seconds, or pardon me, 22 minutes. That would be fast, wouldn't it? 22 minutes. These days, they run the race in less than 10 minutes, but at the time, he was hustling up there. So, and also, there were a lot of breakdowns with these early model race cars, and so they were allowed to take their mechanics with them. He also won the race in 1924, so he won it twice. So who was this guy Penrose, and what was he doing building roads and doing all these things in Colorado Springs? Penrose arrived in the area in 1892. He was invited by Charles Tutt, who he knew from when they both grew up in Philadelphia. They were both from wealthy families in Philadelphia, so they had known each other back then. Charles Tutt suggested that Penrose come to the area and he would share interest in his COD gold mine with him in Cripple Creek if Penrose would manage the mine and also Tutt's land brokerage interests in Cripple Creek. Penrose was all for it. He wanted to be part of the Wild West, and by golly, he found it in Cripple Creek. This was his bachelor pad. It was a mining cabin, and his roommate was another associate. Harry Leonard was his name. Penrose bought a white cow pony that he named Rabbit. He bought him for $25 and often spoke about what a great horse Rabbit was. And it was very convenient that he had a white horse. If anybody was looking for Penrose, all they had to do was go around town and find the white horse hitched up out front of the saloon or wherever he happened to be, and they could find Penrose. So early on, Tutt and Penrose, they did well with the COD mine, by the way, but they also discovered there was a lot of milling that needed to be done with ore coming out of the entire Cripple Creek district. So they decided to start a milling company to process the ore. This is an invoice from the milling company showing Tutt as the president and Penrose as the secretary and treasurer. So they built more mills down in Colorado City, down toward Colorado Springs. Penrose built the Short Line Cripple Creek Railroad to take the ore down to the mills, and the mills became wildly successful as well. So they had building successful ventures left and right. Their engineer, however, said, you really need to look into copper. That's the way to go. And he proposed that he had a process that would allow them to not only process the high-grade ore that came out of the copper mines, but would also process the low-grade ore, so you could actually more than double what you were taking out of the mines. So Penrose looked into the Utah copper mine in Bingham Canyon in Utah and purchased it. He sold it much later for a huge amount of money, and that is where most of his fortune came from. So with the mills in Colorado Springs, when he was back home in the Colorado Springs area, he and Tutt, Penrose and Tutt, had offices in the Colorado Springs area, and he decided that it was time to settle down a little bit. He was pushing 40, and he'd been a wild bachelor for quite a while. So he met this socialite named Julie McMillan, who was a very attractive widow lady. And she had great style, was fun, very intelligent, enjoyed socializing, and was a real good partner for him. So Julie and Spencer were married in 1906 in London, and they went motor car touring throughout Europe for their honeymoon. They discovered that they both really liked touring and traveling, and they did a lot of that over the next several years. Their passports were very busy. They kept an apartment in Paris and a house in Hawaii and did a lot of traveling. Now, when they were back on the home front, Penrose had purchased a ranch, Turkey Creek Ranch, down near Canyon City, and decided that he would like to make that a model ranch for people to come and visit and learn how to properly manage a ranch, manage their livestock. He was breeding pedigreed cattle and sheep, and he had orchards and a variety of enterprises on this ranch. However, he also learned rather quickly that it takes a lot of time and effort to not only run a ranch, but to attempt to make a profit from it, and he wasn't able to do that. So again, his focus wandered from that project, and he laid his sights on a casino and hotel called the Broadmoor outside of Colorado Springs. It was kind of aging and getting a little seedy, and he purchased it for a good price and decided to fix it up and make it a world-class resort. So in 1918, he had put $2 million into construction for a new hotel on the property, another $1 million in furnishings and decorations, and he ended up with a 350-room hotel that he needed to fill. Again, World War I was still going on, so people weren't traveling like they did before and would later. So it was kind of a slow start, but he believed in his venture and carried on with it. At this time, Spencer and Julie Penrose moved from the house they were living in Colorado Springs, to an estate adjacent to the Broadmoor called El Pomar. They purchased it for $70,000, which sounds like a pretty good price considering the mansion had 87 rooms. The property was on 7.4 acres. El Pomar stands for apple orchards. There were orchards and beautiful landscaping throughout the property. So with 350 rooms to fill, Penrose decided they needed more attractions, more activities to lure people out to the Colorado Springs area and to stay at the Broadmoor. So he started, first of all, an endurance ride, which had been a 300-mile Broadmoor endurance ride, it was called, which was popular in the East, but this was the first time a sanctioned endurance ride had been put on in the West. Without going into, you know, deep particulars about an endurance ride, it takes place over 5 days. The rider and horse gain points. It's not a race, but they get points on being able to go through these 60-mile increments of the endurance ride. In 1922, the same time, Penrose applied to the United States Polo Association to open a polo club in the Broadmoor. Now, they didn't have a field, but the Cheyenne Mountain Club down the road had one, and they leased it so that their team could play polo and invite other teams to come play, more people to check in the Broadmoor. So that went on for many years, actually, and in 1928, he did, in fact, put in a field with a grandstand so that the Broadmoor Club had their own home field. And then he decided it was time to build another road up the mountain. So he wanted to build a road up Cheyenne Mountain this time, right behind the Broadmoor. And when somebody asked him, why do you want to build this road? He said, I want to get on top. And Penrose, as usual, had other things up his sleeve, but he was keeping that to himself and was being a little coy about it, I guess you'd say. He also had a menagerie of pets that were rather unusual and exotic. He kept some of the animals at the Broadmoor and some at his Turkey Creek Ranch. As a result, he opened the Cheyenne Mountain Zoo up on his new road up Cheyenne Mountain, and which is still there today, of course, and that became another attraction to lure people to the Pikes Peak region. It was opened in 1926. He had an elephant named Tessie, and he liked to take her golfing with him. So Tessie could carry the clubs and carry Mrs. Penrose while Spencer golfed. But there was a little problem. Tessie left rather large footprints in the beautiful Broadmoor golf course they were trying to establish at the time. So she went to live at the zoo, which was better for her. He had other animals and never lost a photo opportunity, especially when it was something that he was especially interested in. Prohibition in the United States ran from 1920 to 1933, which was a fairly long time, and of course it was right smack in this period when he's trying to build up the Broadmoor. And so it was a thorn in his side personally because he liked his cocktails, he liked to socialize, but also because he had a food and beverage business. And so he prepared for it by stockpiling tons of wine and liquor, not only on the East Coast, but at the Broadmoor, and kept it going that way, kind of trying to work around the law. So in this little photo op, he's pretending to share champagne with the chimpanzee, and as the caption says, Penrose is the fellow on the right. So another project he had on Cheyenne Mountain was the Will Rogers Shrine of the Sun. In 1935, he started building, and that was when Will Rogers died in an airplane crash. He was a very well-known humorist and actor and entertainer, and had visited the Broadmoor, played polo there, and Penrose really admired him. He felt that it was a good idea to honor Will Rogers by naming the shrine for him, so he did. There's a chapel in the basement that's a family chapel where the Penroses eventually, their remains were buried. It was getting toward the end of his life. He built a stadium for sporting events involving horses, mainly a Will Rogers Rodeo that started in 1938. In the other picture is a picture of himself and another fellow dressed to promote the rodeo, dressed in Western style. That is Harry Leonard, his pal from Cripple Creek days. They remained friends throughout their lives. This is a rather rare press photo of Penrose with his arm around one of his trophies that he would present to the best cowboy at the rodeo. And he went to Harvard. He wasn't an especially good scholar, but this is a quotation from one of his essays. And I thought it was apropos, really, for the topic today of bigwigs and benefactors. Because about this time, too, he and Julie started the El Pomar Foundation. Now, that is where both of their fortunes went, and it goes on again to this day, and it takes care of itself. Over 75 years, they usually give away about $25 million a year for grants and stewardships. So Penrose died in 1939 from throat cancer. And as you go around Colorado Springs, as Mike was talking about with the statues and so forth, It's hard to not see evidence of Penrose and what he has done for the community. Julie Penrose lived another 17 years, and she died in 1956. She went on as president of the Alpomar Foundation, and she was a philanthropist in her own right, and especially had cultural purposes that she liked to donate her money to. And of course, the Broadmoor Hotel is still there and in all its magnificence, and still a five-star resort that people from all over the world come to see and to stay and make a destination. And if you're out roaming around and want more information about the Penroses or this time period, definitely stop at the Carriage Museum across the road, which has a lot of artifacts of the Penroses and from that era. And also the brand new Pikes Peak Hill Climb 4,000 square foot museum that's an offshoot of that one that's just opening this summer. It's brand new, so thank you.
Thank you, Joyce. Our final speaker for this session is Eric Schwab. Eric earned a BA in product design from the Illinois Institute of Technology and an MA in sculpture from the Rhode Island School of Design. During his frequent hikes on Pikes Peak, he has encountered considerable evidence of human activity, leading him into researching the history of mining, logging, homesteading, and the development of water and electric power, tourism, and aircraft crashes on the peak. As a volunteer for the Pike and San Isabel National Forests, he has researched the Fremont Experimental Forest, the Skeleton Mountain Ranch, and the Manitou Incline, as well as, for his own enjoyment, local mining activity and old trails, roads, and utility lines. Utility lines, okay. He has prepared exhibits on the Fremont Experimental Forest, the Manitou Incline, and Fred Barr at various regional archaeological and historical associations. Eric.
Thank you, Mike. I have always considered Fred Barr the benevolent benefactor of Pikes Peak hikers. He's credited with building the famous trail from Manitou Springs to the summit of Pikes Peak that bears his name with his own hands. It is clear that he loved the mountains. However, his motivation for building trails was a combination of that admiration and his entrepreneurial spirit. Fred's life begins in Eureka Springs, Arkansas, where he was born in 1882 to William Barr and Mary Wade Barr. They had been married in Colorado Springs just 9 months before. After Fred's birth, the family moved to Idaho, where three of Fred's sisters were born. Next, they moved to Portland, Oregon, where Fred's father owned a livery stable and where Fred's fourth sister was born. His youngest sister was born after the family returned to Colorado Springs. Fred's maternal grandfather was Joel Wade. He owned 160 acres on Colorado Springs and Cripple Creek Stage Road in South Cheyenne Canyon. Here he built a stage stop where passengers could purchase refreshments and nearby workers could come for alcoholic nourishment. Fred enjoyed visiting his grandfather's establishment and hitching rides on the stage to Cripple Creek. These excursions have been exciting introduction to Pikes Peak and may have influenced his love of the mountains. At the age of 18, Fred was a driver for his father's tourist carriage business. The business was located across the street from the streetcar stop where tourists disembarked for a visit to the Garden of the Gods. By 1902, Fred and his father were both proprietors of Barr Station. Their location was across the street from what is now the Red Rocks Safeway supermarket. The Barr family lived there also. The livery business enjoyed some popularity. Dorothy, a travel writer for the Young Woman's Journal, thought highly of Barr's station. She wrote, "Halfway between Colorado Springs and Manitou is Barr's carriage station. There is an opposition stand, so be sure to get the right one." Mr. Barr's was the first Garden of the Gods station. He began with one team, which he drove himself. Now he has a plenitude of fine teams, excellent drivers, and a goodly number of dear, willing, pathetic little burros. Hat drivers do take advantage of tourists. This Mr. Barr never does. He has worked hard to become a fixture and wishes to keep his business straight and right. And just as we regularly went to Barr's, we regularly asked for Mr. Taylor to drive us. For I'm quite sure that these two men made our visits so much more interesting than anyone else could have done. The going rate for a drive to the Garden of the Gods was 50 cents. If you continued on to Glen Eyrie, it was 25 cents more. A trip to High Drive, which took 6 hours, was a dollar and a quarter. Williams Canyon cost a dollar. The competition mentioned by Dorothy was Quinby's Burro Stand. The business was not quite as genteel as Dorothy would have us believe. The newspapers carried a number of accounts of disagreements between the employees of Barr's Livery and Quinby's across the street. On February of 1903, William and Fred were found guilty of assaulting Nelson Cavale, one of Quinby's drivers. Later that year, we learned that George Smith, one of Barr's drivers, was fined $10 in costs on a charge of assaulting Henry Craddock from Quinby's. A particularly graphic account of one of the altercations appeared in the Gazette in 1910. No sooner had a group of women tourists, accompanied by Mr. Gotham, a former employee of Quinby's, stepped off the trolley when Mr. Torrance from Barr's stand made his appearance on the scene brandishing a short club, which seems to have been the approved badge of office for solicitors of tourists. Finding himself unable to secure the fares, he began a torrent of abuse, which frightened the women and caused Gotham to swear out a warrant for his arrest. This was not the last time there were altercations between the drivers of the two stands. More often than not, the Barr's drivers were found to be guilty parties. Fred Barr's first trail building was done to support their business. Barr built trails from the Burro Stand to the Garden of the Gods, to Red Rocks, as well as other attractions in the area. When the Manitou Incline opened in 1908, Fred established a Burro Livery business at the upper station of the incline. He built trails from the top of the incline to three prominent rock outcroppings above the incline's upper station. These vantage points were called Lookout Rock, Eagle Cliff, and Mount Crest Crags, the last of which is still a popular destination for hikers. Fred built a livery office and a corral at the top of the incline. He provided the proper attire for those who were not dressed for the outing. In his office was a fainting room for the ladies. He provided wranglers to guide tourists to those rocky outcrops, to Halfway House, to the Fremont Forest Experiment Station, and to the Bottomless Pit. Around 1914, Fred began searching for a route for his burro trips up the eastern face of Pikes Peak. He completed his survey on Christmas Eve in 1918 when he broke into the Summit House and spent the night. The next day, he returned to town to announce his achievement. The survey was just the beginning. The physical work of building the trail was yet to be done. Yet it marked the realization of one of Fred's life ambitions and demonstrated unquestionably the feasibility of constructing a trail over the most scenic part of the peak, a task that many people thought could not be done. The actual construction of the trail was not completed until 1921. He probably adopted at least a portion of the Fremont Trail, which had been constructed in the early 1970s by the workmen, 1870s, by the workmen from the Denver and Rio Grande Railroad. In 1917, the Forest Service paid Fred $200 to supervise a 10-man crew building a trail from Manitou Springs to the Fremont Trail near the top of the incline. Barr had grand plans for his mountain enterprise. In 1921, he asked the federal government for permission to build a road into the bottomless pit and to the summit of Pikes Peak. His request was endorsed by the Colorado governor and Spencer Penrose, among other prominent citizens. Penrose's support is curious, since he had recently leased and improved the 1888 wagon road to the summit. In that same year, Fred made preparations for the construction of a log hotel near the Fremont Forest Experiment Station. His plan was to build a hotel that would accommodate 50 guests, similar to the one at Glacier National Park. It would be an up-to-date dining room furnished with rustic tables and chairs. In one end of the room would be an immense fireplace around which guests would gather in the evening to tell stories and to listen to lectures about the interesting features of Pikes Peak. Obviously, his grand plans never came to pass. However, he did construct a rather unique hostel higher up on the mountain, just over 10,000 feet above sea level. At the time, it was considered unlike any other camp in the mountains. The first camp consisted of tents and would accommodate from 15 to 50 guests. When it was completed, Barr's trail to the summit became the focal point of one of the region's most popular tourist adventures. The standard outing consisted of Barr outfitting his guests at the top of the incline with burros and supplies. At 5 p.m., he would guide them on the two-hour trip up to his camp. A picnic supper would be served, followed by stories told around the campfire, and then to bed. At 1 a.m. the next morning, he would wake his guests with an all up. Half hour later, he would again gather around the campfire and drink a last cup of coffee before the ascent was resumed. The journey was so timed that the burros reached the summit of Pikes Peak just as the sun rose above the horizon, lighting the east with brilliant colors and gradually spread westward across the sky. These sunrise trips were so popular that they were continued by Fred's successors for more than 20 years after he died. It is likely that by the summer of 1922, Fred had completed a log cabin at Barr's camp. That cabin still exists today and still is operated as a hostel for hikers wishing to rest before completing their hike to the summit, or just as a base for exploring other destinations on Pikes Peak. In 1936, Barr built two more cabins at the camp to accommodate visitors. The same year, he announced that the camp would be open in the winter. In 1930, Barr built another cabin at about 12,000 feet elevation. This cabin also provided shelter for Barr's burro parties. Fred built a trail from this shelter down into the crater, a cirque southeast of the summit. This cabin no longer exists, but it is probably the site where the Forest Service built another shelter in 1964, which we call the A-frame. Barr built other trails on the east side of the peak. In 1921, he built a trail to the bottomless pit, a cirque north of the summit. In 1930, he surveyed the route to the summit of Cameron's Cone. In 1937, he built a trail to the second bottomless pit, which we now know as Ghost Town Hollow, or the site of the Oil Creek Tunnel. Did Fred build his trails single-handedly? Probably not. We have already learned that he supervised a crew that built the trail from the town of Manitou to the Fremont Trail. A newspaper account of the building of the Bottomless Pit Trail tells us that workmen were engaged in constructing that trail while Mr. Barr was in the southern part of the state buying burros. Fred's obituary states that Barr Trail was constructed under his supervision. Whether or not he built these trails with his own hands, we owe a great deal to his vision and dedication. The Barr legend also tells us that he worked winters as a coal miner to earn money to fund the trail building efforts in the summer. City directories for 1931 through 34 list Fred as a miner at the Pikeview Mine. However, in all the other directories, his occupation is listed as co-proprietor with his father of the Barr and Son livery, or as a single proprietor of the Mount Manitou and Pikes Peak Borough livery, or as tourist agent, or simply as chauffeur. 1931 through 34 was the beginning of the Great Depression, and it is possible that his mining career was simply a necessity. During this period, there are no reports of his having built any trails. In December 22, 1922, Fred and Ed McGrath convinced three of their hiking friends, Willis McGee, Harry Standley, and Fred Barr, that they needed to do something exciting to celebrate New Year's. They settled on a hike to the summit of Pikes Peak. On December 31st of 22, they set out for the summit, hiking the Cog Railway right away, carrying a dozen one-pound rockets and several dozen flares. When they arrived at the summit house, they broke in, built a fire in the stove to thaw out. Not a new experience for Fred. At 9 p.m., they set off a couple of rockets and let the folks at home know that they had made it. Then at midnight, they set off the rest of the fireworks. On their return, the Frozen Five decided to make this an annual tradition. They also agreed to add one person to the group each year, assuring the celebration would continue. Hence, the group became known as the Add a Man Club. This began a tradition that residents of the Pikes Peak region still look forward to each New Year's. I'm behind a little here, aren't I? Subsequent years, the club usually hiked Barr Trail, starting on December 30th and spending the night at Barr Camp, finishing a climb on December 31st. Fred was always the first man up New Year's Eve morning. He broke the ice on his creek, had coffee hot and ready in his 2-gallon coffee pot. He is said to never dump out the coffee grounds, but nearly added more coffee and more water and set the pot to boil on his sweet-smelling wood-burning stove. Physically, Fred Barr was of medium height, slender build, and gray eyes, light brown hair. He was 46 when he married Anna Edna Williams of Colorado Springs in 1928. She was 6 years younger than he. During the tourist season, Fred and Anna lived in a one-room cabin at the top of the Manitou Incline. Anna sometimes accompanied Fred on the trail. She was the first tourist to enter the crater. Each year, she made the trip to Barr's camp to cook for Fred and the workers while they were giving the trails a spring cleaning. She was with her husband on their way to a place where a rock slide had blocked the trail when a burro that was carrying 50 pounds of dynamite slipped and fell off the trail, rolling over twice. The dynamite did not explode, and Fred helped the animal back to his feet, and they were on their way again. Surprisingly, Fred was also a musician, playing French horn in the Colorado City Band. He was a member of the American Federation of Musicians. Given that his mother was a music teacher and his father a musician in the Union Army during the Civil War, maybe this isn't so surprising after all. Just how much formal education he had is not clear. However, here we see him enrolled in a night class as an adult. Fred Bard died of a heart attack on April 2, 1940, in Willard, New Mexico, where he and his wife were visiting his sister, Agnes. He was 58 years old. Anna survived him by 25 years. They had no children. Anna and Fred are buried in Evergreen Cemetery in the same plot with Anna's parents. On December 1949, the Adaman Club built a cairn and erected a sign in memory of Fred Barr a short distance above Timberline. The sign, which is long gone, read, "This cairn erected by the Adaman Club December 31st, 1949 to honor Fred Barr, builder of the Barr Trail. Hikers on this trail were asked to add a rock as they pass. Barr Trail is the most popular trail on Pikes Peak and is the venue of many special activities, including the Pikes Peak Ascent and Marathon, the Barr Trail Mountain Race, the Route of the Adaman Club, ascent of every New Year's Eve, and the return route for most of the estimated 400,000 ascents of the Manitou Incline made annually. In spite of his modest means, Fred Barr's vision and dedication continues to have a positive impact on our recreational opportunities and on the tourism of the Pikes Peak region. In closing, I would like to thank these institutions and individuals for their contributions to my research."
I'll ask our speakers to gather up here, and as they're coming up, when we're done with the question session, we'll have a break until 11 o'clock. Tim asked me to point out that the restrooms in this building are to your right as you leave this room, and I'm assured that they are not from 1904. They are thoroughly modern. So, Joyce, you want to step up here, Eric and David? And recall, I'll repeat your short questions. Any questions? Yes, sir, way back there. Did the Penroses have families, the question?
Descendants?
You want to?
Okay. Did the Penroses have family? Julie Penrose had a daughter and descendants through the daughter's family. Spencer Penrose and Julie Penrose did not have children together, so there were no other children descendants.
Another question. Yes, sir.
For Eric, on the way, we had the city staff on the city road, that 160 acres, is that part of the National Forest now, or is that still private deal?
The Joe Wade stage stop, is it part of the National Forest now or not?
Most of it is. But a part of it is still privately owned. There's a very nice
house on it. It's at one of the curves in the old stage road as you drive it up. I can't remember the address, and I'm in touch with the owner's sister to try and get permission to see the property. The picture that I showed is long gone. I think it burned in the 30s. But he had 11 cabins on that site. And I think that maybe one of them may be incorporated in the house that's there now.
Another question. David, I've got a question. Over here. Are there any monuments to Van Diest in town?
I can't think of any monuments to Van Diest in town. No, I've been around quite a while. Anybody can correct me on that, but I don't know of any monuments. I know that if you're interested in a lot of detail about him, about his work, why. Jesse Randall at Special Collections at Tutt Library can be very helpful to you, and you better set aside a few hours to go through those boxes.
I'm just, as I was thinking about this whole symposium topic and listening to people, who gets a statue and who doesn't? You know, who gets a bust or a bas relief or something like that? Maybe one more question. Yes, ma'am. Okay, there's a park named after Van Diest. Located where?
Wow.
Wow, okay. That's your assignment as we take our break.